a sudden, there shined a shiny demon in the middle of the road. And he said,
play the best song in the world, or I'll eat your soul.
Well, me and Kyle, we looked at each other, and we each said, okay. And we played the first thing that came to our heads, just so happened to be the best song in the world. It was the best song in the world. Look into my eyes and it's easy to see, one and one make two, two and one make three. It was destiny. Once every 100,000 years or so, when the sun doth shine and the moon doth glow and the grass doth grow. To say, the beast was stunned. A whip crack went his rumpet tail, and the beast was done. He asked us, be you angels? And we said, nay, we are but men. Rock. Just a tribute. Couldn't remember the greatest song in the world. Now this is a tribute, oh, to the greatest song in the world. Alright, it's the greatest song in the world. Oh.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free-thinking historian.
Hello, and I'm Don, your political science philosopher.
Hello, I'm Rob, the cognitive psychologist and frazzled note-taker.
And I'm Daniel, and I've never shared a mic before. This is a little too close to Rob.
Welcome back, Daniel. It's been a while since you've been on our show.
What have you been up to?
Working every single Tuesday. Couldn't do the show. Kind of sucked.
The only one of us that is gainfully employed.
Well, welcome back, Daniel.
Not anymore.
So what's going on and this week in science?
So we have a couple of stories this week. We have a few. They're related to sort of basic concepts of science, the sort of stuff you'd learn about in high school, really. One of the big ones frazzled note-taker, as I said before, I didn't write down who did this, but a group of scientists have gotten a detailed close-up picture of a molecule, the individual molecule. They used an modified version of the atomic force microscopy, which detects the way the molecule looks using sort of like using a magnet to figure out where some metal ball bearings are, looking at where how the forces interact with the tip of the atomic force microscope, which is actually a molecule.
Kind of like a needle on a record player, but instead of physical grooves, it's magnetic ups and downs.
Yes. And the thing that's really cool about this is that it's such a detailed picture, you can actually see the atomic bonds between the individual atoms in the molecule. And what's really cool is that you're looking at this picture, and you should Google this and find the pictures. It's really, really cool. And it validates all those like models that we've been building of molecules based on sort of blurry images from electron microscopy and the mathematical formulas that have predicted the way they shapes.
So it looks like those little like balls that you have the sticks between them that sit
in
the science classroom.
Yeah, they have the same sort of structure looking like that. It's really, really cool.
But I thought quantum mechanics said that you couldn't actually, I mean, the bonds would be hydrogen bombs, I'm assuming, or something equivalent to that you could visualize. But I thought you couldn't see that because of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle.
The way that they measure the bond structure collapses the waveform, I'm assuming. Okay. This is way beyond me. No. I'm not a physicist.
So we can see where they are. We just don't know where they're going.
Exactly. Just like my life. The other cool thing, there's been some neat genetic research being done recently. And one thing that's sort of the basis of evolutionary theory is that there is a base mutation rate in DNA transcription. Whenever DNA is transcribed and copied, there is a sort of baseline mutation rate that allows differences to show up in different the progeny of creatures.
Is this something like, I know there's a thing where they're trying to create a genetic history where you can go back in time and you can find out when different cultures have diverged from a common ancestor based on the different mutation rates? And
yes, that's one of the ways that they sort of construct the tree of life, as it were. And so a couple of Japanese scientists, I think, or maybe Chinese, sequenced the same sections of DNA from groups of two men separated by 13 generations, because you get really large, really, you know, massive age differences in families in Asia. And they found the base mutation rate by looking, basically rapidly sequencing these bits of DNA using technology that didn't exist even 2 years ago, and comparing them, you know, nucleotide by nucleotide, and found that the base mutation rate is about one mutation in each 15 to 30 million nucleotides.
Cool. But this is just two people, though?
I believe it was just two people. This is following up from other base mutation rate research, and it fits with estimates from other studies.
So they just took two people and said, well, see how far back you go before you're related to each other type thing?
I think it was just to see how different the DNA between the longest
I think the point
time
is
difference
they started
find.
Off, there's one common ancestor, and then they took a look at these two gentlemen who are 13 generations away from the common.
Yeah.
And they compared the two and said, okay, we know where they started, and we know where they are, and now we've got a clock
to see what difference there is between 13 generations of progeny from
that. Would be really fascinating if you could get someone who perhaps ancestor was English, and maybe one went off to the New World and one stayed in Europe. See what happens there.
It'd be very cool.
And I'm sure they've done studies. Actually, this reminds me of a study I heard of just recently. Actually, it was an experiment where in some people, they have a problem with their genetics, but it's not their main genetic codes. It's in their mitochondria. Mitochondria, little energy power plants in your cell, and they have their own DNA.
Yeah, mitochondrial DNA is passed down from
usually
from
your mother. Right, because it's part of the egg as opposed to part of the sperm. But some people have genetic problems with that. So they did some experiments with some monkeys where they took the nucleus, I guess, of one mother and put it into the egg of another. So you had the mitochondria from one parent and the nucleus from another. So the newspapers are saying the child with two mothers.
I've heard about this, the research of babies with three parents and stuff like that.
Exactly. But I was just wondering what that sort of thing would do to this base rate changes. Because I know one of the things that they use for the out-of-Africa theory is using mitochondrial DNA as their clock.
Yeah, to trace back to this, you know, through the mother's line. Because it's easier to measure. Well, and I have one more grab bag story with genetics. It's very the headline: scientists create dinosaurs by tinkering with chicken DNA.
Haven't we learned our lesson on this one yet?
we've all seen Jurassic Park, so
we know. The person that's doing, he hasn't actually done this yet. He's starting a series of experiments to basically flip certain genetic expressions in chicken embryos and see if he can reproduce dinosaur anatomy. And it's actually the Canada Research Chair in Macroevolution, Hans Larsen. And he said that he was inspired by Jurassic Park. And I'm just sort of wondering, did he not read the whole book or see the whole movie?
Well, you know, those raptors, they looked pretty fake. I'm sure that if the chicken turned into a raptor, we'd all be safe.
I mean, be sure to raptor-proof your homes.
Well, they can open doors.
Crap, we're screwed.
Well, why don't we go to a quick commercial break, and we'll come back with a very controversial discussion.
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station. Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on. College radio can pretty much be summed up in five words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Oh, And we're back. Hi. We're going to do a little segment now on an article that I read by Christopher Hitchens in Vanity Fair called Why Women Aren't Funny. Christopher Hitchens did this article based on a Stanford Medical School study by Fran Lebowitz and Nora Ephraim, where they did a study that showed that women's brains respond to humor differently. Now, that's where the root of this comes from, but he takes a lot of very interesting sidesteps from this if you read the article. Essentially, Hitchens makes some big claims. One, he says, socially speaking, being funny is a positive attribute for males, as in males are evolutionarily selected to be more funny than women. That humor in men can be used not only as a form of attracting mates, but is also used as a form of aggression between men. That women, sense of humor is more intellectual, whereas men's tend to be more lowbrow, and again, part of that aggressive thing. He makes the statement that, evolutionarily speaking, there are some good reasons for this humor dimorphism. That men who lack other attributes can use humor as a way of attracting mates. And from what I understand, Rob or Elon might be better to help with this, he also says that as a form of aggressive behavior, it's much easier to fight someone with humor, which is less costly physically than it is to do it with fists or clubs or whatever. So again, there's an evolutionary advantage there. The study that he cites, at least from what I got from his article, it's only one study in of 20 subjects.
That's not a very large N, not really much power for your statistical significance.
I agree, actually. And that's where, I mean, Hitchens, I like his writings, but I was going, as a skeptic, that set up a red flag, right? And it's funny, too, because he mentions that the researchers themselves say that the differences you see in the world, as far as differences between men and women in humor, are actually more cultural memes than evolutionary.
Well, in my opinion, this is Elon. I'm here from Ottawa. In my opinion, I think this article, the value of it, aside from it just being entertaining to read, is it makes good, strong evolutionary arguments, which are, in evolutionary psychology, that's sort of like the start of the process. Is, you know, he makes this comment about how men sort of need this extra thing to be able to attract women. So even if a man is like not attractive, he still has this last ditch effort of trying to be humorous, and that's his way to.
I gotta point out though that I don't think that's really the case for the vast majority of human history. Women have not been in control of the reproduction, men have. And humor, I don't think, had any factor in that. I think it was all about power and influence and control. I don't think it's only been in the last 150 years that we've had to attract women. It's been about, you know, people have been in control. It's either their fathers, their husbands, or someone else. It's
never right, really Ethan, been about- I agree with you. Don't forget that much farther back, if we go forgetting about humans, like it wasn't always like patriarchal parents thing. Like sexual selection is a real thing that happens where men and women are sort of competing and having sexual selection occurring, which is making men certain qualities in men women find more attractive, and the same men find certain qualities in women more attractive. That's how we've evolved these qualities.
Do you think that humor is one of those qualities? I mean, wouldn't it be like health, abilities?
Oh, certainly. Just what I was saying is, though, like Hitchens makes this evolutionary argument, which might sound like feasible, might not. But in evolutionary psychology, once you sort of have this theory or like sort of an evolutionary psychology theory of why you think a certain thing is how it is, then you have to actually do a study and you have to test it.
I think the article, it actually is in a section of Vanity Fair entitled Provocation. Christopher Hitchens deliberately wrote it to provoke some rather angry, controversial responses. But I think it also does submit some interesting ideas that are based possibly in evolutionary psychology, but that have yet to be actually tested. And I wasn't even sure if I agreed with the premise of the article that men need to be funny in order to attract women. So I did some background research, and I didn't find anything related to that directly. But I did find Dr. Rod Martin, who did a study at the University of Western Ontario 1 year before Hitchens actually wrote this article, which basically did large surveys and concluded that men don't fancy funny women because they
they find it threatening, and this is based on sort of their responses in their survey. And so I sort of pursued this line that men don't want women to be funny because they find it threatening. There is some support for this. Richard Wiseman actually ran a large-scale experiment. He called it Laugh Lab, the scientific search for the world's funniest joke, in quotes. He set up a website, asked people to submit jokes. They cut out all the, you know, sort of naughty ones, the good ones. Mm-hmm. They had a team of researchers rate the jokes on their content. And it led credence and support to the superiority theory of comedy, which basically says that comedy lies in feeling better than someone. So that the jokes that rated the highest, the jokes that were the best, were the ones that had a fall guy, the sort of joke where, you know, you get to feel smarter than someone, you get to feel superior to someone in some way. So this sort of suggests to me that if there is any truth at all to, you know, women are less funny than men, it's not because of anything inherently evolutionarily psychologically, but possibly because men don't like funny women, whereas they do enjoy funny men.
I think actually you bring an interesting point. I mean, one of the things that the study did show is that women, their brains are more activated when they hear jokes. And I'm curious to know whether that study you mentioned took into consideration, you know, the idea of dimorphism between the sexes. Because I think, and again, this is not a scientific study, this is more my own personal experience. I mean, if you look in the world, male humor tends to be far more physical. I mean, one of the great quotes, farts are always funny. Well, only a guy would say that. Women seldom find farts funny. They tend to find other things more humorous. And maybe that is a reflection of the fact that part of the evolutionary advantage, going with Eason's point, that maybe in the last...
That sexes have different humor.
Well, yeah, in the last 2,000 years, let's say, aggressive humor has been an advantage for males, whereas it hasn't been for women. So that's why, evolutionarily speaking, maybe we have changed. Men have created a greater dimorphism.
But of course, it doesn't necessarily have to be evolutionary. Like, I mean, not saying that I support one or the other, but this could also be just a cultural phenomenon, the idea of nature versus nurture. Like, maybe it's just that men are raised to be funnier. I mean, this is all assuming that the original, you know, theory is true, that men are funnier, but like the reason why doesn't necessarily have to be something that's evolutionarily happened to our brains.
Again, I would agree with that, but there is that one, the study does bring up, there is a physical difference that implies that there had to have been, I mean, maybe before patriarchal societies evolved, maybe women did select on that. Because one of the theories of the origin of humor is the fact that it's a reflection of our ability for pattern recognition. True humor, if I can use that in quotes, is a upsetting of an expected pattern, and we find that humorous. That's the origin sort of humor.
There is the theory of cognitive dissonance as leading to humor.
Isn't the fact that men and women have different chemical or neurological brain effects kind of like a duh question? I mean, of course we have different brain chemistry. I think that if we're going to associate, perhaps, in my opinion, a stereotype to a biological difference, isn't that the foundation of racism?
The sort of thing where the biological differences in the brain chemistry of men and women are such that if you're going to attribute differences in senses of humor to that, you're going to have to attribute the same explanation to the differences in sense of humor between members of the same sex. You and I have completely different senses of humor. We have different brain chemistry, sure. That's a non-explanation.
It's also important to note, though, Hitchens doesn't say that men and women have different senses of humor. He said that men are funnier than women.
I tried to look up some statistics for this to see whether, you know, there was some evidence that men were, in fact, funnier than women. There isn't a lot of demographics on this, so I did rather unscientifically I typed in top 50 comedians, looked at the winners of the last comic standing reality TV shows. And let me give you some statistics here. Comedy Central published a list of the 100 greatest comics of all time. 11 women were in the list out of 100. Only Ellen and Roseanne were in the top 20. Of 8 seasons of Last Comic Standing, only one winner was female. And she was the only one to ever make it into the top 3 in any season.
It's funny, too, actually. You're bringing up another sub-point that Hitchens goes off on. Is he does say that there are exceptions to the men are funnier rule, and those tend to be, to quote, dykes.
Jews and uglies or something?
Butches.
And you know what's really funny? You know, we have Ellen, if you want to call her a dyke. Perhaps that's a little offensive. Roseanne, nasty butch biker chick. the winner of the female winner of Last Comic Standing was in fact a Jewish comic.
So confirmation bias.
This list and the fact that there's not so many women on the list might just be a sign of the times. Like, I'm sure if you looked at a list of the top 100 actors of, you know, all time, I'm sure there's more male in that industry.
This is completely unscientific statistics.
This is all nurture, though. I mean, this is socialization. It's like saying that, you know, women aren't good soldiers because the majority of our military is made up of men. Because, you know, women are taught to play with dolls and boys are given, you know, toy guns, right?
It's more based in our culture and society than in evolutionary psychology that there seems to be this idea that men are funnier than women. That's what I'm saying. I don't really buy Hitchens' premise or his support for the idea that men are funnier than women. I think it's thought that men are funnier than women for a variety of social and societal reasons.
But to deny that there could be one because it might be seen as sexist, I think that's bad science. I think we are evolutionary animals, and there might be some sense into there being dimorphism. I mean, obviously, women are different than men. And why is that? Maybe the reflection in culture of men being dominant in humor isn't a cultural thing. Maybe it's a reflection of a genetic difference, and that might be valid to look at. It might prove totally wrong, and that's where science is self-correcting. But I mean, I think Ethan at least is ruling it off too quickly. Again, one of the parts of this study showed that there is physical differences.
Right, yeah, there's physical differences, but what could possibly be the motivating factor for humor to be an evolutionary advantage? I mean, let's think about what are some of the evolutionary advantages that we've developed. You know, we breathe air, we can run fast, we have opposable thumbs. Where does telling jokes help us survive as a species?
Well, I told you.
I think you're forgetting about sexual selection as a key factor in our evolution. To summarize my point, at least, I would just say that I agree with Don pretty much in terms of there's definitely could be reasons that this could be true. And I think from reading Hitchens' article, I think it's compelling and I think it's interesting. I mean, I don't think we should take it as gospel because there's not actually much evidence yet to support it. But if you're going to make a scientific claim, it has to be supported by evidence. Fun article anyways. Whether you agree or not, Hitchens is an entertaining guy.
He is. Do we have consensus for the end of the segment?
Yeah, it sounds pretty good.
Okay.
All right. So we'll be right back after this.
Thanks.
When you first learned about the birds and the bees? Want to learn more about the birds and the bees and the berries, urban agriculture, delicious homegrown food, solar energy, and much more? Check out the Society Promoting Environmental Conservation. Come to one of our workshops, join our solar panel tour, or go to our website, www.spec.bc.ca, for more information.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. I just wanted to say one really quick thing about that discussion. I think that the idea that we could make a vast generalization based on one study with a very small sample size is purely bad science and bad skepticism. And that's all I had to say about that. Moving on.
Hold it. No, then I get to say one thing. I think the fact that we should limit research into something because it might be construed as sexist or racist, I think, is also bad science.
Okay, I would agree with that, but I think
Let's move on.
This is something that is determined, you know, on how people teach science, which brings us to our next story.
Fine. The Globe and Mail recently had an article that was raising some interesting questions about teaching science. A survey of about 200 science teachers has found that the provincial exams are, quote, sucking the life out of their classes. The rationale is that these exams don't encourage understanding of the scientific method, but a rote memorization of the facts, and that learning the intricacies of how science works through research and experiment doesn't factor into these exams.
It's basically the old problem of teaching the test. When the teachers have, you know, a set curriculum, what's going to be on the exam, they have to focus entirely on teaching what's going to be on the exam because that is the only measure of the success of their students and the success of themselves as teachers. They focus entirely on this one thing, which is not exactly teaching how to be scientifically thinking.
And it goes to the point that without this sort of hands-on approach, students will just hate science. I know when I was in high school, I had teachers like this, and it was a horrible experience for me. Now, the hands-on approach, you know, teaching through experimentation, research, not to say that you shouldn't have a qualified level, but that it should be more focused on actually learning the scientific method as opposed to learning the atomic weight of cobalt.
No, I read a research paper recently that looked at a number of different methods of teaching and looked at some studies and sort of did a review of the research, and they found that lecture, the sort of basic unit of teaching in almost every institution in North America today, had the least amount of retention and attention on the part of students out of any of the methods of teaching, ranging from experimentation to online lecturing to reading the textbook yourself.
Well, it does raise more interesting points. I mean, the BC Teachers Federation has requested that standardized tests be halted, and there's a lot of support behind sort of this movement to remove standardized testing. The Fraser Institute here in BC has advocated that it not be removed, but given that standardized testing generally has a bias built in towards sort of white middle-class males, it does raise some interesting questions here. What exactly are we teaching? What is standardized testing creating a standard of?
Well, let's stop there for one second.
Okay, let's go.
The BC Teachers Federation does have a slightly differing reason for that. It's not all about the kids' education. It's partly because standardized testing is basically, it's one strong way that we can look at how efficient or how effective teachers are. And so they don't want to, the BC Teachers Federation, like the teachers don't necessarily want that as their grade for how good of a teacher they are.
But Daniel,
and if you take that out, you will literally have no objective standard. I'm not saying it's a good objective standard, but to think that they're doing it purely for the sake of the kids is a little bit of a...
But Daniel, see, the thing is, universities right now, with standardized testing in place, are saying that students are coming out of high school lacking basic skills in reading, science, and math. Already, we're seeing poor results. So what are we trying so hard to protect when the system already isn't working?
Actually, you know, I find this funny. Ethan might know this from some research, maybe not from historical, recent things. In the 50s or whatever, there was standardized testing. It was. They didn't call it standardized, but I mean, it was to the book. And they said, well, that was too constraining. We need to teach children how to learn. So in the 60s and the 70s, they changed the paradigm into, let's teach them how to learn, how to get it, experimentation, exploration, and that was good. And then in the 80s and the 90s, they said, well, now we're coming up with students who don't know how to read or write, and they don't know their multiplication. So they went back to standardized testing again.
Sort of like the swinging pendulum.
And we're getting, it's funny, because I mean, I'm hearing some of the same arguments that I would have read about in some of the articles I read in the 60s.
And isn't the 60s or 70s when the U.S. was the big scientific leader in the world? I mean, that is along with your point, actually. But I do definitely think that teaching to tests is bad, don't get me wrong, but I'm saying schools need some objective measure that you can compare teachers, compare schools, and I'm not saying it's a good one that we currently have, but there has to be something or else that's potentially more dangerous.
I'm not against the double standard. I've always argued for regulation and keeping tabs. Are things effective?
So if anyone has any ideas about how to test, you know, how to grade schools and teachers' performance and make sure that kids end up having capacity for critical thought, please write to us at radio.freethinker@gmail.com.
Well, we are running right out of time, so I'd like to take this opportunity to recommend to our listeners to check out a blog entry on science-based medicine by Harriet Hall. She wrote a response to a very, very poorly made documentary that aired on the CBC's Doc Zone called The Disappearing Male. And the article has a link to it on YouTube, and Dr. Hall wrote a really great article, point by point, takes it on, points out all the pseudoscience and logical fallacies. Hopefully the CBC will take some notes.
And for my skeptical highlight of the week, it's a new section that where, you know, something that we thought was interesting we should check out. Mine is in my birth province, Manitoba, the premier retired from premier, then like the next day he gets appointed as the ambassador to the United States. And then about three days later, the Liberal Party are threatening an election. I just think it's something interesting for people to check to see how politics really works and how a potential enemy of the Conservative government, Doer, who's an NDPer, is taken out of the political sphere just in time for the upcoming election, our potential election.
I'd like to remind everyone perhaps you don't know this, this year is actually the 50th anniversary of a very famous lecture a physicist named C.P. Snow gave to the public in 1959. It was entitled The Two Cultures. In it, he talked about the divide between scientists and the intellectuals of the humanities. And to paraphrase him, he basically said, why is it considered a massive faux pas for a scientist to not know the basics of a Shakespearean play, and completely normal and all right, and actually somewhat of a mark of pride for someone who writes novels or studies the arts to not know the second law of thermodynamics?
Well, very good points. And we're out of time, so... Yeah, we're out of time. So, sorry, Daniel. We're out of time, so join us next week on Radio Free Thinker.
Big government and big pharma have entered into a secret conspiracy in which secret government contracts are sold to big pharma that allow for secret chemicals to be placed in coffee seeds, all under the watchful eye of Big Coffee, who is secretly working with other world forces, all in a sinister plot to get alien embryos in our coffee so Big Pharma can sell us alien contraceptive pills. Or, if you'd rather get some rational news, check out Radio Free Thinker, the radio show / podcast that promotes skepticism, critical thinking, and science education. Every Tuesdays at 4 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Hello, everybody. You're listening to CITR Radio here on 101.9 FM. Hope everybody is having a very nice and pleasant Tuesday, the second day of the week.